This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Well, you think the town you live in is strange? In Jeff Vandermeer's latest novel, the main character Rachel lives in a city half destroyed by drought and conflict, where a giant flying bear preys on victims just trying to stay alive, and where the flotsam of a derelict biotech company might offer the best chance for love and connection. Jeff Vandermeer is a best-selling science fiction and science fantasy writer, the author of the award-winning trilogy Southern Reach. Jeff Vandermeer's with me now, along with his wife and editor, Ann Vandermeer. His new novel is called Born. Jeff's going to be reading from the book Saturday, July 22nd at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill. Hello, Jeff.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Good to have you. Hi, Ann. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Good. Jeff, tell me about the place you've created in Born.
Well, it's actually not, it's definitely got some fantastical elements, but it's not that far removed from certain places in the world right now that have been changed or ravaged by climate change. And so there's a psychological reality that kind of grounds the book and keeps it from, no pun intended, flying away. and so I wanted to deal with some ecological themes in a more urban setting than the prior trilogy, which was mostly about wilderness areas. And I've been very happy with the reception so far. You never know when you have a giant flying bear in a book how readers will respond.
It's going to turn out. With a flying bear, though, describe this landscape, because, yes, it's very much like places that we have already created through the consumption of fossil fuels and climate change. But it is worse in many ways. So give us a feel.
Yeah, basically, the landscape is littered with these discarded products from the company, and they're biotech creations. They're made creatures, and this is something that we're kind of dealing with now as we more and more find gene splicing to be very, very easy, or easier than it was, and as the distance between product and animal kind of closes. And you see many situations where there are multinational corporations that come in and strip an area of its resources to make products for some other richer area. And so it's kind of like that, but more fantastical and more extreme, because in this book, climate change is farther advanced. And so the city itself is in this kind of desert landscape, and the abandoned biotech is actually a way that Rachel, the main character, the scavenger, can survive, because she finds abandoned bits of it, and she gives it to her partner, Wick, who is an amateur bioengineer who makes other creations that he then sells or barters. And the crux of the thing is that Rachel comes across this bit of biotech that she can't abandon, that grows, that becomes sentient and speaks, and that she raises more or less like a child. And it's kind of an act of faith, and actually kind of a trusting in the future that she actually trusts this thing and tries to raise it as a child, because it's very much, she could just give it away for parts. And, right. And that's kind of the crux of the novel.
Well, and that is it. And that's the mind meld here, which is that this kind of corporate greed and commodification of life is the problem. And for those who believe compassion is the answer, you've got Rachel at the very crux of this. Can I show compassion for this thing that emits, for all intents and purposes, a thing that evokes compassion and is the very product that brought us here?
Right. Well. And part of the conflict in the novel is that Bourne is raised to be gentle, to be what Rachel wants Bourne to be. But Bourne may have been created to be a weapon. And so there's this disconnect between the two things as he grows and grows and learns to change shape and disguise himself. That I think is kind of central to it. And then central to it, too, is what you mentioned, is that in a lot of post-apocalyptic settings, you see, it's just a landscape of militias and horrors. And in actual fact, as we're seeing as climate change displaces people, you see lots of acts of loving kindness. You see people trying to stay connected, try to promote family, to find connections and love, even in the midst of very difficult circumstances, because that's part of the human condition, too. And so I really wanted to reflect that, and I wanted the hope in the book to be hard won, but I wanted it to be there. And then I also wanted some humor, because early on, when Rachel is teaching Bourne about the world, their conversations are fairly humorous and a little bit based on my own conversations early on with my stepdaughter when she was like 7 or 8.
Well, maybe I can ask you to read for us.
Yeah, sure. Here's a section where Bourne is actually asking questions.
Mm-hmm.
And Rachel, this is after Bourne has learned to speak and to change shape a little bit. Then Bourne would ask some of his questions. He never stopped asking them, as if he were really ravenous for the answers. This dust is so dry. Why is dust so dry? Doesn't it need some wet for balance? Then it's mud. What's mud? Wet dirt. I haven't seen mud yet. No, you haven't, not yet. I would show Bourne a photo of a weasel in an old encyclopedia, and he'd point with an extended tentacle and say, "Ooh, long mouse," which brought me quickly to the idea of teaching Bourne to read, except he picked that up on his own. When we played hide-and-seek, I'd sometimes find him hunched up on the edge of a midden of discarded books, two tentacles extending out from his sides to hold a book, and a single tentacle tipped with light curling down from the top of his head. He would study any number of topics and had no real preferences, his many eyes enthusiastically moving back and forth as he read the pages at a steady clip. I don't believe he needed light or eyes to read, but I know he liked to mimic what he saw me doing. Perhaps he even thought it was polite to seem to need light, to seem to need eyes. But the truth is, I don't really know what he thought or how he thought it, because most of the time, I just had his questions.
And Jeff Vandermeer. Jeff is reading from his new book, Bourne. He'll be reading at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill on Saturday, July 22nd. So give us, Jeff, a deeper sense of who Rachel is as we learn more and more about Bourne.
Yes, well, she is a climate change survivor, and the island nation that she hails from is actually underwater, and so all she has are the memories of that place. And one thing I wanted to show in the book is how potent memory is in terms of holding on to something that's lost. And it also comes into play into how she perceives Bourne, because when she first sees Bourne, he looks a little bit to her like a sea creature from her youth, and so it brings up all these nostalgic memories. And as the novel progresses, she has all these choices she has to make with regard to Bourne, in terms of how she sees herself as a parent, in terms of the larger situation in the city, which is deteriorating because the giant flying bear is getting more and more ferocious, and there are other enemies for both her and her partner, Wick. And so she has a lot of choices and a lot of things that she needs to work through at the same time that, you know, this is a street-level view. She is trying every day just to simply survive in this world.
Anne Vandermeer, you edit Jeff's work. You're also a publicist. And I wonder, and I don't know if it's fair, but I think it might be fair to say that in that very successful trilogy, the Southern Reach trilogy, landscape really was a very large character. And this book, Bourne, focuses more on human characters or, you know, more traditional characters. Is that fair to say as you read this book? And did that strike you as a change in Jeff's work, a kind of change in direction?
Well, there was definitely a different emotional connection in Bourne because, again, as Jeff was saying, there was all these conversations between Rachel and Bourne, which mimicked a lot of the conversations that Jeff had with my daughter, Erin. So I recognized a lot of those conversations, so it was kind of funny for me. But in reading the Southern Reach trilogy, I recognized a lot of the setting. So in some sense, you could say that the Southern Reach was where the setting was as much of a character as the characters were, where in Bourne, it was more about those relationships between the characters. And I also wanted to point it out that I am not Jeff's editor. I happen to be an editor. I am his first reader. I do read everything that he writes. I usually get to see it in bits and pieces. But I think one of the things that happens between us more often is that as we do hiking, and we hike a lot in St. Mark's, which is where Southern Reach is placed. But as we do our hiking together, we'll kick around ideas. He'll be thinking of something in his mind about a scene that he wants to do or a character that he wants to talk about. And he just kicks around these ideas with me and we just talk about it. So in that sense, I'm more of a sounding board than actually his editor in these projects where he's telling me different things and I'm asking him a bunch of questions. And that's the way that I approach all of my editing projects, whether I'm working with Jeff or any of the writers that I work with for Tor.com or any other books that I've done in the past, is I usually try to approach the writers and their work by a series of questions, making them think about how they need to look at their work.
Can you take that work or that conversation as a kind of a blank slate, or on those walks and in those talks, do you think of the body of Jeff's work and his readers and how they might take this next new idea?
Well, I'm not really thinking about the readers, except that I'm thinking about myself as a reader when he's telling me these different ideas. I'm usually trying to see if there's any logic flaws or if something is kicking me out of the story or if it makes sense. So when he's talking about that, I'm not thinking about his past body of work. I'm thinking about the one project at hand. And the reason being is that everything that he's done is always different from the previous project. He does not repeat himself. Some people might see bits and pieces in one book that are similar to something in another book, but they're actually completely different. So every single project that he does, I've seen it as a completely standalone, separate thing from what he's done earlier.
Jeff, how do you take it when Anne says, that'll never work?
Well, you know what? She's the only one who can read my work in process without me getting writer's block. I learned early on, if I told the story in process to anyone, that I would never finish the story. And then I met Anne, we got married, and I took the chance again, and it was like, oh, okay, I guess this is in the marriage contract that I don't get blocked if I talk to Anne. And so I don't really get defensive, but she does have a habit of sometimes reading something and then making me ask if she's read it and then having me draw it out of her. And I know that she says that that's because she's then subject to what she calls the interrogation, because I will ask all my questions.
did you even read that passage? Read that
right,
again.
Exactly.
It was brilliant.
And actually, we did, in part, we met when I submitted a story to a magazine she was editing that was a terrible story about a giant frog and a magic prom. And this is way back when, and she rejected it. And then I emailed her or sent a letter and said that it was a test of whether she was a good editor, that I knew the story was terrible, which is, of course, a lie.
So it wasn't a test.
It wasn't
a
test.
It was a terrible story.
This is how Jeff says you're right. It's very strange.
Yeah. And you know what? I'll tell you something. He's never had that story published anywhere.
There you go.
There you go.
Right. She tends to remind you. Do you wear that on your? You should pin that to your, you know, your lapel or something. Anne,
well, she does remind me of it every once in a while.
Tell me more about the flying bear. I want to get back to Bourne for a second here, and about the flying bear. Tell us more about it and the role it plays in your story.
Well, the flying bear Mord is a giant, like five or six stories high, very much a monster. And I always had in my head that this story would be like a Chekhov play in the round with these Godzilla versus Mothra monsters fighting it out in the background and trying to find a balance between this personal and this epic scope with the fate of the city and the balance. And, you know, I didn't expect it would fly, but the initial thought I had was of Rachel finding Bourne, this nascent bit of biotech in the matted fur of this giant bear. And then in my mind, the bear flew off, and I had to then think, am I going to let that bear fly? And I thought of a book by Angela Carter, a novel called Knights of the Circus, where there's a flying woman in a circus, and she never tells you whether it's true or not, whether the woman's actually flying or there are wires. And I thought, I'm no Angela Carter, but I think it's really kind of interesting for this bear to fly. And I do give an explanation later on for why the bear flies, but it also kind of helped signify what the novel was. It wasn't going to be hard science fiction. It was going to be this combination of science fiction and fantasy that's probably more familiar from like animated films and anime and manga. And that allowed me some distance that I think was appropriate, because I wanted to explore these ideas of like rogue biotech and this kind of future, but you know, I wanted to do it in such a way that there was room for some psychological resonance that you can't necessarily get from the same direction if you do straight science fiction.
All right. Can I get you to read for us again?
Sure. And this is actually a section where Rachel and Bourne have gone out on their first scavenging mission, with Bourne leaving their sanctuary for the first time since she found him. And they're trapped on the rooftop of an abandoned factory by ferocious bears, normal-sized bears, that are loyal to Mord, the giant flying bear. And so Bourne disguises himself as a rock with Rachel inside, hidden inside of him, since he can change shape quite a bit by now, so that the bear won't see them. A moment more as the bear circled the Bourne rock, and the claustrophobia would have sent me over the edge. But Bourne sensed this. Bourne knew what was happening within and without. The space widened, and a dull green light came from the flesh walls all around. And a flesh book extended out of the wall, and on a shelf that formed, I saw a flesh telephone. The telephone shook like it was ringing. I picked up the receiver. "Hello," I whispered. "This is Bourne. This is Bourne calling you." "I know," I said. I felt like a child on a pretend phone having a chat with an imaginary friend. "You don't even need to make sound. I'll hear you if you mouth the words," Bourne told me. "What is going on outside?" I mouthed, even as Bourne lurched a bit from some push off to the left of me. "The bear is circling me. The bear just pushed me, and I rolled a bit like a rock, but only a bit because I'm a rock, not Bourne." "Good. Maybe the bear will go away." "Should I be afraid, Rachel?" "Are you afraid, Bourne?" "I worry the bear might eat part of me." "Bears don't eat rocks." "I worry that if I worry too much about the bear eating part of me, that I will stop being a rock and then the bear might eat me." You must be a rock. I willed Bourne with all the force of every secret thought. A rock. I'm going to end this call, Bourne said. I think the bear is about to do something else. Goodbye. Goodbye, Bourne, I mouthed. Goodbye, Bourne. And hello, Bourne, all around me.
Jeff Vandermeer reading from his new book, Bourne. He's going to be reading at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill Saturday, July 25th. And I'm talking with him and his wife, Ann Vandermeer, on the state of things. As you speculate on these things, Jeff, I wonder how you remain, see compassion as still part of the picture. And this is sort of beyond the scope of the book and talking about your imagination, because it seems to me that with the possibilities of both genetic engineering and also our reliance on, I mean, the fact is, if I could get a Fitbit that would actually, you know, like feed me the nutrients that I needed, right? Right. I mean, think this through. Who wouldn't buy the thing that says, just keep me at peak physical health and you can take my, you know, my free will? I don't need that. I want the Fitbit that's going to keep me strong, which is to say, you know, are we becoming a different species? And how do you even imagine that compassion is any part of our future?
Well, I think part of it is there's a lot of scientists and whatnot saying that we need to take a step back and we need to think about the consequences of the things we're doing, because there's a lot of ethical and moral discussions that need to be had to catch up. And the reason that everything's going so fast, of course, is what someone who works on a renewable battery told me, which is that to this point, biotech and biomimicry hadn't gotten very far because it doesn't work in a capitalist system, because there's a lot of R&D up front that isn't profitable. But now we're finding cases where it is profitable, and so they're going ahead so fast because something's potentially profitable that they're not asking those hard questions, and the science is being left behind. And, you know, it's just like when you introduce, when an invasive species comes to an area in an ecosystem, there are unintended consequences. And it's not being alarmist or a Luddite to say, you know, let's take a step back and let's think about what we're doing. Let's think about how we've already ruined parts of the planet and we've created situations where the natural balance is out of whack, which, you know, doesn't just hurt animals but also hurts us. And at the same time, you know, I know a lot of passionate scientists who are working really hard on these things, who haven't lost hope about climate change. You know, my stepdaughter is one of them. She's an environmental economics person. That's her degree, and she works for the World Wildlife Fund, doing reports on sustainability for the next 20 years. And her work and others really makes me hopeful, and that's kind of where the hope comes from. But as I said before with Rachel, you know, I wanted her life to be hopeful. I wanted this to mean something, but there is hardship in it, you know, because I think there's also a mistake in dealing with this issue in an escapist way.
Yeah. No, utopia is the bane of us all. If we just give that up, things would be a lot better for all of us. I think we'd probably stop creating the world that we're living in if we didn't think utopia is the answer. Hey, talking about kids and the future, you and Ann are currently in South Carolina at a camp called Shared Worlds. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, Shared Worlds is the dream project of Jeremy Jones. He's the one that created Shared Worlds and brought us in. And it's one of the best things that we do each year. We love it. This year is actually our 10th year of doing Shared Worlds. So Shared Worlds has made it to 10 years. Woohoo! In the first week, the kids are broken into groups and they do world building where they get lectures in geology and map making and history and religion. So they get to negotiate with each other as they try to create their worlds. And then in the second week, they write stories in this world, and they're working alongside with guest writers who are assigned to every group, and those guest writers work with the kids. They critique their work, and they do one-on-one sessions. So it's really a great opportunity, and if you want to talk about hope, hope is in those kids.
All right, yeah. There's the hope. I'm going to leave it right there. We will not speak another word. That sounded great. Jeff and Ann Vandermeer. Jeff is a science fiction writer, science fantasy writer, and award-winning author of the Southern Reach trilogy. His latest book is called Bourne, and he is going to be reading from that book on July 22nd. You can find out the details at our website, stateofthings.org. Jeff and Ann, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, a best-selling author, Matthew Quick, talks about his new novel, An Aging Vietnam Veteran Navigating Civilian Life. Stay with us on The State of Things.